Happy Friday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by our colleague Sarah Longwell at the end of a long week that, I don't know, Sarah, did you feel, I feel like things actually, this is, it's ending on a good note. It's been a normally shitty week, but it's ending a little bit, you know, on an upswing.
Is that because the cyber ninjas had to say that they didn't find any bamboo in the ballots, or is that what's got you in a good mood?
Is this like the most delicious breaking news story that we've had in a really long time? I feel like we've been in a good news desert, and then we get this story that the cyber ninja audit not only confirms that Joe Biden won, but that he won by an even wider margin than originally reported. I'm sorry. I just got to take a few minutes on this, right?
Yeah, this was not what it. I saw that Trump put out a statement last night being like, tomorrow's the day, but seemingly unaware that the report had already been leaked, showing that Joe Biden had, in fact, won the election. And I don't know about you. I was surprised they didn't find any bamboo in the ballots. I know that they were looking for it, but it just didn't seem like they found any evidence of that.
Well, who got to them? I mean, something. I have to admit, I'm kind of looking forward to the various forms of spin. I want to hear MAGA spin on this. I want to hear the anti-Trump spin on all of this. I am going to enjoy this because I'm sure who will be the first columnist who said, well, all of you people who questioned the cyber ninjas and called it a fraud, what do you have to say now? I think it's a race between National Review and the Washington Examiner going with that spin, right? Where does the cyber ninjas go to get their apology?
That's true. I mean, I do think based on this sort of draft that's out and some, that there's going to be a bunch of ridiculous claims in there that, yeah. Well, when we counted the votes, you know, the votes were – yeah, like in terms of that the votes were right in terms of the count, but that doesn't mean that the election was run well, and here's all of our criticisms, and here's all the shady things that we right. still want to throw in there to cast doubt on the election. And so I don't think it's going to be, you know, a complete and total exoneration
They'll throw chum, yeah.
They'll still do that stuff.
Well, see, but this is the whole pattern where you have all of this rhetoric about, you know, questionable fraud and not definitive and et cetera. But then when you get to the actual raw numbers, they don't back up any of the rhetoric. It's kind of like what we went through when you had, you know, the Rudy Giuliani's of the world, you know, claiming that there was all kinds of things that were wrong with the election. But the moment they stepped into a courtroom and had to say it to a judge, it was like, yeah, no, there's actually no fraud. So the numbers are there. Hand count shows that Trump lost Maricopa County by 45,469 votes. The county results showed him losing by 45,109 votes. So they spent, what, $6 million, the overstock guy, on an audit that showed that Trump lost Arizona again.
Yeah, and you know, I think besides the delicious dunking, that's fine. The important thing here is that I do think it will have a chilling effect. I mean, on some of these other states that were planning on going forward with audits of their own.
I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. So they're messaging tools, right? The audits are messaging tools. They are meant to just create an atmosphere of the idea that there was something wrong with the election. I do think a lot of these Arizona officials, like it was the fourth audit, I believe, in Arizona, but it did start to get very embarrassing for Republicans as it went on. And you started to see people in the state legislature, you know, Jan Brewer even came out. And you know, it forces certain Republicans in the states to say, no, Joe Biden won. I mean, it actually creates some difficulties.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. You're right that they may go forward with it because it's not like these are the most sane or reasonable people, but there is downside.
Oh, there's definitely downside. But of course, this would have a chilling effect in a world in which shame actually mattered, when facts actually made a difference in all of this. But last night, what was it? Trump is demanding that Texas now perform an audit. He won Texas by 600,000 votes, and yet he wants Greg Abbott to have a forensic audit of Texas, or at least of areas where Democrats vote. So, in Earth 2.0, where we are rational, good faith actors who are capable of shame, this would be embarrassing and it would slow the momentum in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But we don't live in that world, Sarah.
We don't. But I would just like to throw out, give two cheers, is maybe three cheers. What's the most cheers that make when you're really being serious? Three cheers?
Yeah, three cheers.
So I want to give three cheers to William Gates, not that Bill Gates, but another William Gates down in Arizona, as well as Stephen Richer, the Maricopa County supervisor. These two Republicans have been, from the start, the loudest voices pushing back against this fraud that's been going on in Arizona. And they've been heroic. And, you know, unlike some more nationalized figures, they haven't kind of, you know, Stephen had like one video that went viral of him pushing back. But generally, people don't know who they are, which, why would anybody know who the Maricopa County supervisor is? Those are not typically names that become nationalized. But they have been true heroes and steadfast throughout this, telling the truth. Without some of these local officials, I mean, you know, this we're probably going to talk about that Bob Kagan piece in the Washington Post a little bit later. But at one point, he sort of talks about that thin layer that stood between you know, what Eastman wanted to happen and Trump wanted to happen in terms of just total usurpation of the election. That the layer was this like small group of brave people that you've never heard of, basically. I mean, most people hadn't heard of Brad Raffensperger or Langeveld there in Michigan, who was, and those people were the ones that kept us from that fate. And it's people like Stephen Richer and William Gates. So just wanted to throw out a three cheers for them. Five cheers, all the cheers.
Well, okay, this is a really important point because ultimately you do need to have Republican officials who are willing to stand up against this. I get in some of these debates with people who are saying, you know, Charlie, why do you keep talking about Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney? They are not the solutions because they're still conservative Republicans, et cetera. No, I'm sorry. You need, you know, ultimately, if you're going to save this process, you're going to have Republicans saying, no, we are willing to admit that we have lost. And I think that's one of the real big tests. And, you know, you mentioned the Bob Kagan article, which I want to get to, because he argues, and this is a must read. People have to go read this thing in the Washington Post. And he says, our constitutional crisis is already here. This is not something that we're, you know, can anticipate in 4 years. Can I just read a little bit of it?
Please.
The United States is heading into its greatest political and constitutional crisis since the Civil War, with a reasonable chance over the next 3 to 4 years of incidents of mass violence, a breakdown of federal authority, and the division of the country into warring red and blue enclaves. The warning signs may be obscured by the distractions of politics, the pandemic, the economy, and global crises, and by wishful thinking and denial, you know, hey, memo to Russ, do that. But about these things, there should be no doubt. First, Donald Trump will be the Republican presidential candidate for president in 2024. The hope and expectation he would fade in visibility and influence have been delusional. Second, Trump and his Republican allies are actively preparing to ensure his victory by whatever means necessary. Trump's charges of fraud in the 2020 election are now primarily aimed at establishing the predicate to challenge future election results that do not go his way. And I think that's exactly right, Sarah.
Yeah, when JVL and I were just talking about this on the Secret Pod, that this column, which is epic, and so much of it is things that we already sort of think and say, but it was so clear, so clarifying, but it made me feel seen. Because, you know, we talk about Bill Kristol is alarmed. I have always felt like we are underreacting to this moment. And, you know, on the live stream last night, we were doing a lot of beating up on Democrats for the way that they are treating this moment as kind of politics as usual. They're having all these policy wrangling, you know, fights. And I feel like somebody needs to, underscore that we are actually in an ongoing emergency,
right?
And focus our attention on that. And I think that's what Bob Kagan did so well with this article. And the other thing that he does, I mean, because he does sort of take Democrats to task for that, but he also, you know, goes after these sort of the good Republicans, and I think correctly, even people like Mitt Romney, who I love, and I think has behaved as good as an elected official could on the Republican side. or he is the best. He's the absolute best. And yet, totally insufficient to the moment. Totally acting as though, you know, he can still kind of just stay on the lawn, stay a good Republican by treating it as though it is business as usual, and you have your normal partisan fights with Democrats. But this idea that Kagan lays out of there's sort of a legitimate way in which Republicans are undermining democracy through normal political battle, and then there's an extra legal and illegitimate way they're doing it by, you know, cheering on the people who participated in January 6th, refusing to have to do any oversight or have a commission that gets to the bottom of it. You know, all of the things they do at the local level to lionize the people who participated in January 6th, and that those two things exist in concert, where the legitimate hand, the right hand, can pretend like it doesn't see what's going on in the left hand.
Yeah, I mean, to underscore this sense of emergency, I linked in my newsletter to this survey out of the University of Chicago, which says that 21 million Americans say that Biden is illegitimate and Trump should be restored by violence if necessary. In June of 2021, nearly 1 in 10 Americans said that using force to restore Donald Trump to the presidency would be justified. Okay, so that's only 1 in 10, but do the math on that. That is millions of Americans. This is dangerous. And I think, you know, look, there are people out there who genuinely have been drinking the Kool-Aid and believe that the election was stolen and, you know, it said, believe the big lie, probably think there was bamboo in the ballots in Maricopa County. But then there's this whole class of cynical Republican elected officials who know that it's all bullshit and yet are throwing the boob bait to the bubbas, who think that if they just sort of go along and they appease the base, that they'll get through this. But they don't know the beast they're feeding. They don't know the damage that they're doing. Or maybe they do and they just don't care.
Yeah, and they do what I think is the blocking and tackling. This is always how I sort of felt about the anti-antis, which is they saw the same problem that you did as a never-Trumper.
Right.
It's not like they saw the different world. They just decided that the way they were going to operate with that information was to say that the other side was worse, to be mad at us for calling it what it was, and to do all the necessary spade work, the blocking and tackling, so that all of that horrible stuff we were seeing going on could go on unfettered and just move forward. And that, to me, has always been the worst part of all of it, because those are the people if during Trump's era there was a moment where people could have rejected it, where the elites could have refused to go along, but Kagan fingers very accurately the Rich Lowrys, the National Review types, who basically looked at their readership and said, we've either got to feed this beast or we've got to walk away from, you know, or the enterprise can't succeed because the electorate has changed. And rather than leading, rather than staying with the position that they had held only months earlier, they decided to feed the beast and jump in. And that's made all the bad difference.
So before we get to our rank of punditry about Dems in disarray, which feels so tired and everything, just a couple of more things on this January 6th, which this is not about the past. This is about what's going on right now in real time, in plain view, and is setting the stage for something even worse coming up. I do believe that. Okay, so here's some developments in the last 24 hours. You have the House January 6th committee issuing subpoenas for Trump aides, including Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino, Kash Patel. This seems like a good development. They're being very, very aggressive. They've learned the lessons of slow walking this from watching how the Trump White House has behaved. And then we get this report that the Biden White House is leaning toward releasing information about Trump and the January 6th attack. Now, that would set off a legal and political showdown, but I tweeted out yesterday, do it. Absolutely. This should not be a close call for the Biden White House. If you have information about what was going on in the White House on January 6th, release it. And I think those would be major developments. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to get closer to the truth and to keep this in the public eye. But we know how short our attention span is. And of course, once again, we live in a world without actual shame or consequences.
Yeah. And we also, I mean, regardless of what the reality is, I mean, I don't know what else you need. Like one of the things you say that you're in a good mood, we're finishing off the week with, you know, the Cyber Ninja report coming out, confirming the election results. Okay. But what we saw this week, one of the things that's actually made me the saddest and most alarmed, because I have been pretty freaked out this week. And one of the things was that the Eastman memo came out.
Yes.
It is a 6-point plan. Like just right there in black and white.
In writing. They put it in writing.
Not
here's
hypothetical.
Our plan for criming, right?
This is how we do it. And we know that Trump was trying to get people to actively do it. They were trying to implement it. And but for a couple people like Mike Pence and a phone call to Dan Quayle, it might have happened. And the fact that it came out this week and nobody talked about it in the mainstream press. Not
Thank
nobody.
You.
I cannot believe how little attention it got. I mean, I've done two focus groups with swing voters since then. No one's heard about it. No one knows what we're talking about when we say, so have you heard about this memo that shows that Trump was trying to undermine the election? You know, Eastman memo from his lawyer, anything, ringing any bells? Just blank looks all across. And that's because, what, ABC, CBS, and none of them covered it. People aren't treating it as though it is the bombshell smoking gun that it is. And so, look, I want every subpoena. I want all this information to come out.
Yes.
I'm just losing confidence that people haven't just baked it in. And this is why the Kagan piece is so exactly right on. There's this something is happening psychologically to us where we're incapable of seeing just how dangerous all of this is. We're just not taking it seriously enough.
Okay, so I am totally with you, and I've been tweeting out, I am amazed this has not gotten more attention because it is a memo showing how serious their attempts were to overturn the election. And I'm more and more convinced that Donald Trump woke up on the morning of January 6th thinking that there was a real chance that he was going to be reinstated as president of the United States. And I guess the media, kind of the too cool for school approach is like, dude, we saw that. We covered it, right? I mean, we all knew that he was cooing. So can we talk about the missing blonde girl story again or something? But it is kind of amazing. I just have to have one little gripe here because I made this point last night on television that this story about this memo, a prominent legal advisor to the president, prominent member of the Federalist Society, laying out a scenario to nullify the presidential election, to overthrow the election, should be on the front page of newspapers across the country. And this retromingent hack who works for, the Media Research Center, whatever, his name is Curtis Hook, who's actually too dumb to really be dishonest, but he put out a tweet, you guys, Charlie Sykes is here to tell you that he's upset the news media aren't spending more time filling up page one of newspapers with stories about January 6th. Yes, he really said this. Well, no, Curtis, I was talking about the Eastman memo and you knew that. But anyway, that is my gripe. That is my gripe. But I was concerned about that as well. And so I wonder, and I think the point you're getting at is that even if the January 6th committee comes out with more bombshells, even if we do find out more stuff that was going on the TikTok from within the White House, the media will go, yeah, it's an old story, right?
It's sort of. It's also just that I think that we shouldn't wait is what I mean. Like when you say like, okay, they're moving fast, they're moving aggressively, like there's subpoenas. I guess part of me is like, I can't believe how few subpoenas there have been. Mm. I can't believe how little how long everything has been taking from start to finish. Like when Trump issued his pardons, I can't believe how everybody just kind of shrugged. Like every piece of criminal activity and grifting and total corruption has just
Steve Bannon
washed
Roger
over
Stone.
Us.
those things were completely corrupt. They were in broad. See, this is the thing though. They do it in broad daylight. So people
totally.
Go, if you had discovered it in some other way, it would be like, oh my God, this is massive. But he does it again in public, and you're right, the Roger Stone pardon, the Steve Bannon pardon, in themselves they should have shaken people, but it was like, it's Tuesday.
That's right. Trump does a president in a normal universe over there on your Earth One or whichever one is the real one.
I don't know. I've lost track.
Whichever one's the alternate one. Trump was doing something that in that world would have been presidency ending every week.
It is every week.
And but that's we're so desensitized to so much of it. Then people know what happened on January 6th, at least.
We need to move on, go to more slow journalism. Okay, so would you like to play my I have an even scarier scenario game with me?
Okay. No? Yeah, I guess. Yes.
Okay, so 2024. There's a 2024 election, plays out roughly like 2020, and Congress has to meet to certify the results of the election. Who is presiding over that session? You, of course, know the answer is the Vice President of the United States, who is, we believe, Kamala Harris, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's imagine that for some reason, God forbid, President Biden is not able to serve out his term. And Kamala Harris becomes the President of the United States, let's say in 2023, okay?
Okay.
I'm just playing the game, okay? Yeah. So she's the president. Who is the Vice President of the United States?
Doesn't she pick? They wouldn't pick someone?
Yes, they would. And then what happens? Then that person, as every school child knows, has to be confirmed by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. Now, imagine you have Kevin McCarthy in charge of the House after the midterms. And imagine, we're just playing a game here, okay? I'm not saying it's going to happen. And imagine that you have Mitch McConnell running the Senate. Is it at all conceivable that a Republican Congress would refuse to approve anyone that Kamala Harris would pick to be vice president?
Well, of course it's conceivable. Okay. We've seen them do it with the Supreme Court.
So you have no vice president of the United States. So who then, when they count the electoral votes in 2024, would preside over that process? Because there's no vice president of the United States. The position is vacant. It has been blocked by Republicans in Congress. The answer is, because I checked with the Senate parliamentarian earlier this morning.
Chuck Grassley?
It could be. See, it would be the president. That's good.
It's the pro temp, right?
You are exactly right. It would be Chuck Grassley who would be, fresh upon reelection. Okay, by the way. Okay, is it ageist to say that it's nuts for an 88-year-old guy to announce that he's running for reelection to a 6-year term? Is that crazy? I mean, what is this? It's like we're going to be run by what? I don't know.
I cannot tell you how much I want to be a United States Senator because I want to know what it is about this job that makes one be willing to do anything at all costs to hold on to it.
Oh, they must have good massages or something. So anyway, in the story of our future politics, which will be known as Tales from the Crypt, you have Chuck Grassley up there. So I'm just pointing out that lots of bad things can happen. So I my alarmist scenario is that whatever you've sort of come up with in your mind, there's probably something that it's even more dysfunctional. Okay, so do you want to talk about the Dems in disarray punditry?
Yeah, I've got. I've been quite alarmed by the Democrats because I'm as alarmed as I am about Republicans. Somebody has to be in a position to stop the Republicans.
Yeah. Right?
So we need somebody up to the task. But you, please segue us in.
Oh, you're going to like this segue. Okay. I just want this is going to be a segue for the ages. All right. So I am looking at the most recent piece by Amy Walter from the Cook Report, who's explaining why she thinks Democrats are ultimately going to pass both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the bigger reconciliation bills. And basically, she says, if they fail to do so, it's only going to add to the perception that Biden lacks a firm grip and a steady hand of leadership. And for Democrats who worry that Biden's declining fortunes are dragging them down, failing to give him a victory will only make things worse for both him and them. A midterm election is a referendum on the president. When he flops, so does his party. And Amy Walter, I think, is absolutely right. And by the way, you just did a podcast with her, didn't you?
Oh, I did. We should talk about that at some point.
Did you see what I did there?
I did. Oh, so, well, we should take her point, the point she's making in this piece, first, and then I would love to talk about the podcast. But this, so I hope she's right. I hope she's right about the Democrats, you know, getting it together, and probably she is.
Yeah, not losing their minds, not basically taking a hammer and smashing their foreheads with it.
That's right. Although I have never understood the politics of the big reconciliation bill. I haven't understood the incentive from the Republican side. I mean, when you get 19 Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, to vote for a bill, you run with that bill. You take that win, you pocket it. And why these, you know, sort of the far progressive wing of the Democratic Party is insisting that it be tied to a reconciliation bill for $3.5 trillion. Not only that they know Republicans won't support, but that they know the moderates in their own party won't support, to me was just like, what? I don't know what game they're playing there.
Well, they're playing a game of chicken, and I love the punditry that says, well, $3.5 trillion is not a lot of money. I mean, the real cost is $6 trillion. And you're kind of looking around and going, okay, guys, seriously, you know that people can hear you talking. There are people out in the world. Yeah, you know, one of the points that I've heard you make is also that, you know, Democrats are convincing themselves that they have to pass these massive spending bills in order to win elections. Trust me. What percentage of the voters could even tell you what's in that $3.5 trillion package? It's so big, it's so unwieldy, they have no actual messaging for it, do they? I mean, it's just like, it's just crammed with stuff. So
yeah, these bills are too big to take credit for. Like, they're just so big that the only thing you do is actually take a hit from a lot of swing voters who are like, what are you, like, why are we spending all this money? It's freaking us out. We're worried about inflation. We're worried about the debt and the deficit, which is something that is still on a lot of swing voters' minds. And at the end of the day, there's, you know, you would be so much better off passing like three sort of darling priorities for Democrats and being able to message hard on them than passing these massive bills where no one knows what's in them.
Right. So let's say you want to push through an extended child tax credit, which is wildly popular. Well, I think it's wildly popular. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Force an up or down vote on it. Spend a couple of weeks messaging it, explaining this bill, building support for this measure. But they're not doing any of that because it's all crammed together. So, I mean, what are you hearing in your focus groups about this? Because my sense is that the Democrats are not getting credit for this money. In fact, people are focusing on the fact that they're just spending a shitload of money and it might lead to inflation. So that, in fact, while Democrats are convincing themselves they need to spend as much money as possible, it's not playing as well with swing voters as they seem to imagine.
They're getting zero credit for the swing voters that I'm talking to. And look, I understand the theory of the Biden presidency, that they are going to come in, they are going to take big swings, spend a ton of money, in their minds, materially improve people's lives, and that that is going to draw back to the Democratic Party all the voters that Joe Biden is used to appealing to, white working class voters, you know, the everyday working person. Like, this is his, you know, I'm from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Like, these are people he's used to appealing to. And I think that they, like something that is endemic in our politics right now, fail to understand how much things have changed. Those white working class voters who belong to unions, who used to be economic Democrats, they are now cultural MAGA Republicans. And those voters are voting for Republicans over things that have nothing to do with money. They're doing it because of critical race theory and Dr. Seuss and lots of other things tied to race. And that the voters who Joe Biden, who really sort of put him over the edge, which is Black people and college educated, you know, suburban, white suburban voters that are quite a bit more moderate. A lot of those voters aren't as comfortable with these massive spending bills and would much rather he be focusing his political capital in other places. And they are also, you know, they look at what's, you know, right now, look at what's happening on the border. You know, Joe Biden is taking, it's not exactly a Trumpist approach to the border because he's not demagoguing it, but he is, rather than sort of talking about how do we resolve this problem with compassion and with, you know, the bigness and vast generosity of America? Like, because we want people to come here and we want to figure out a way for a path to citizenship and for people who are persecuted in other countries to come to America. That's who we are. Instead, you know, the optics of sort of lassoing Haitian migrants at the border, Trump would have owned that and loved that and leaned into that. But instead, Biden's going to get that pincer hit from Republicans who are saying, look at this crisis at the border. You can't handle it. As well as Democrats who are like, what are you doing? This isn't what I wanted from you. And so I just think that they have a theory of the case and voters that they're going to appeal to. Like, I think part of the reason he wants to be tough on the border is that they look at the numbers and they see that a lot of, you know, majority of Americans are very worried about immigration, but his voters want him to handle this a totally different way, not in a Trumpy way. So some of
his voters, I mean, this strikes me as also reflecting the diversity of the Democratic coalition. That while Republicans are essentially driven by ideology, Democrats are this unwieldy coalition, and so part of that Biden coalition, you know, does want there to be something quasi like open borders, quasi like opening, welcoming, emphasizing, you know, compassion, humanitarianism. But a good chunk of that constituency also is looking at that, saying this is crazy. We can't have, you know, 10,000 Haitians just, you know, huddling under bridges and, you know, coming into Texas and things like that. You got to do something about that. You do need to send them back. We can't take care of all of that. So that also reflects that, I don't know, just it's a complex, maybe insolvable problem, but also politically, he really is stuck between these numbers, aren't they? I mean, you know that whatever he does, there's going to be a constituency in his own party that's going to be unhappy with him.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what people expected from sort of the compassion pitch that Biden made is that what they'd be seeing at the border are images of Americans giving these migrants blankets, food, and treating them with, you know, humanity before saying like, but I'm sorry, you cannot come in, or like, here's the way to start the legal process. And then they also, I think, want to hear from Joe Biden, what is our plan? Like, what is America's vision around immigration? But nobody wants to do that. Everybody's just trying to figure out how to handle, because we're in sort of this constant crisis. And I think that this is, you know, one of the things that's just, it's tough for Biden. This is, we're lurching from crisis to crisis.
And yet there's an opening here because, and I am slightly obsessed with this. I have spent 20 or 30 years writing and talking about things like, you know, critical theory and, you know, where it becomes illiberal, where it be, you know, identity politics, you know, is so reductionist. But on the other hand, we're at a point now where there are folks, influential people on the right, like Tucker Carlson, and I'm sorry to say Charlie Kirk and others, with no blowback whatsoever, who are openly embracing white racist themes like the replacement theory. I mean, Charlie Kirk goes on radio, whatever it was he was on yesterday, calling for basically armed militias to protect the white demographics of America. And Tucker Carlson is, you know, talking about how they want to replace legacy Americans with non-white people in order to win elections. I mean, this is stuff that used to be confined to places like, you know, the Daily Stormer, and now it's on Fox News. And as far as I can tell, Sarah, there is no pushback in the Republican Party at all, which means that the Republicans are becoming more and more normalized to embrace the hardest core white identity politics that I can remember seeing since the 1950s. That ought to be a moment for Democrats, a clarifying moment, but I don't sense they've seized it yet.
No, I mean, I'll do my whole spiel on this, which is that, you know, because Democrats have a lot of policy things that they affirmatively champion, they spend their time trying to message on that and push their agenda forward. And because Republicans do not have many policy agenda items that they want to affirmatively champion, they spend all of their time defining Democrats by their most extreme members. They do incredible high-level narrative work. And they've taken the Squad and they've made them famous, and they've defined the entire Democratic Party by the Squad. Democrats, conversely, on the right, there's a guy named Paul Gosar. He's a congressman from Arizona. He regularly goes to white nationalist conferences and speaks. There's Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's Louie Gohmert. There's Lauren Boebert and Madison Cawthorn and Matt Gaetz. And there are just so many of these. I mean, Jim Jordan. There's just so many of these. Like the crank side of the Republican Party is now, I mean, 160 of them refused to certify the election. Like, the crank side is the mainstream of the Republican Party, and yet Democrats have failed to adequately define the Republican Party as too extreme to govern. And that is a bit, that is what has to happen going into 2022, is that there's people have got to get serious about trying to tell America who, and Republicans are going to help them out, because Trump's going to show up. And he is going to endorse people like Herschel Walker, who you may have seen today.
Oh,
Mitch McConnell
is
warming to. Like Eric Greitens, who tied a woman up in his basement, photographed her, blackmailed her. And he scammed a veterans charity. Josh Mandel there in Ohio, lighting masks on fire and generally saying insane things. Those people should be, you should be able to Todd Akin them in one big, you know, swoop and say the party's lost its mind. But instead, they're fighting with each other over the dome in Israel. And whether, and this is where, just to go back to the point on immigration, this is where I just wish, you know, I think that if Joe Biden, or I do wish there was somebody sort of younger and more dynamic at the helm who was kind of pulling everybody together and saying, guys, we have an emergency with the Republican Party, and we are all going to sit in this room and we're going to hammer it out behind closed doors, and we're going to figure out, you know, what we can, and we are going to present a united front for democracy, and you know, just and because I think that one of the things that I think is happening when you say, like, well, Joe Biden's got to balance these things, that's true, but he's not articulating to us, the Americans, his plan. He doesn't articulate to his party their plan, like. And this is, I think, the frustration from people like us is just what we need right now so desperately is something that looks like competent, clear leadership. Yep. And instead, it's disarray.
Okay, so a couple of points here. You got me going here. The success of making the Squad the face of the Democratic Party is really extraordinary, because I think we got a glimpse yesterday about how small their influence is and how isolated they are. You know, you had a group of progressives who somehow decided it was a good idea to scuttle funding for the Iron Dome, which, by the way, is strictly defensive. If Israel did not have the Iron Dome, more Jews would die, but also more Palestinians would die, because the only alternative then to shooting down the rockets would be go and have a land invasion and kill lots of people in order to take out the missile launch. So anyway, so they cut out $1 billion for Israel's, you know, defensive Iron Dome, you know, from the stopgap spending bill. They brought it back up as a standalone measure, and the vote was 402-9. Just 8 Democrats voted against it. You know, you have people like, you know, Representative Jamal Bowman. You have Rashida Tlaib and others and other fellow travelers who went along with all of this. But they certainly do not represent the mainstream of the Democratic Party in any way. And yet, what is the difference between, I mean, what is the delta between the Madison Cawthorns and the Matt Gaetzes and the mainstream of the Republican Party? You know, I'm agreeing with you that it's to make the progressives look like they represent the Democratic Party seems, you know, grossly and easily, I mean, grossly inaccurate and dishonest, and easily refuted by votes like yesterday. But the Democrats have not succeeded in pointing out these crazies. Now, you mentioned Herschel Walker, which is, you know, this guy is, there's, and on Earth 2.0, there's no way that he would get close to a Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. He's, you know, he's been involved in so many crazy things, including, you know, the Russian roulette stuff and the various scams. And now Mitch McConnell is warming to him. And you raised the name of Todd Akin. And you, I know you and Amy Walter talked about this on the podcast. You know, there was a time when if you said something crazy, now Todd Akin was running in what state?
Missouri.
He was running against Claire McCaskill, and he talked about, what was it, the legitimate rape. Legitimate rape. Okay, it was one phrase talking about legitimate rape, and that was considered to be disqualifying. And there were a couple of other incidents, you know, throughout the, you know, earlier part of this century where U.S. Senate candidates blew their entire candidacy up by saying one or two really stupid things. And I was really struck by your discussion with Amy Walter on your new podcast, which I strongly recommend, about whether or not the Todd Akin effect even works anymore, or whether politics has changed so dramatically that a politician who said something like that now would suffer no repercussions.
Well, we know that that's true. We know that that's the case. I believe J.D. Vance said something yesterday.
Yes, just yesterday.
About it being inconvenient for women to carry their rapist child to term.
Inconvenient.
This is the kind of, it reminded me, like I was thinking about this last night when I saw that comment, that would normally be disqualifying, but we've now gone through 4 years of Trump. And this is, in the podcast, I have Bill Kristol on next week when the episode drops on Monday. And one of the things that I talk about there, listening to these voters who are sort of normal-ish people who were really on the fence about voting for Trump, but either went third party or ultimately did vote for Trump, and they were sort of explaining why. And you can see how desensitized. Like, these are voters who would have been scandalized, 10 years ago by something like that. But Trump has totally desensitized them to, you know, shocking phrases or shocking opinions and ideas. I mean, I was doing a focus group with swing voters, and I was asking them about Herschel Walker in Georgia. And it was a different moderator. The moderator said, well, have you heard, you know, that he's had some mental health issues? He talked on the Howard Stern show about why he played Russian roulette with himself. And does somebody who plays Russian roulette with themselves, with the bullet in the chamber, does that give you pause about electing that person to the U.S. Senate? And these were people who voted for Biden, mind you. And one person said, well, he must keep on winning. And the other person said,
that's pretty funny.
And the other person said, I don't think he'll do that while he's senator. He'll probably stop doing that. And like, this
probably.
I just think this is the kind of thing that has, where we really have, our entire culture has become so filled with insanity that people have built up a tolerance to a place where the kind of thing that Todd Akin said that got him, that helped him lose in a place like Missouri, I don't think, unless the Missouri Democrats find themselves a Republican, a moderate Republican to run on the Democratic side, like Eric Greitens not only might win the Republican primary because Trump will endorse him, he might very well be the next U.S. senator.
But he's not leading in the polls yet, is he? I mean,
what happens when he gets Trump's endorsement?
Yeah, see, this is what's interesting. I was actually trying to make a list of the most blowable Senate races this year. Where you would normally have an easy shot at holding the seat, you know, places like Ohio, Missouri, the Republicans could blow these seats. Democrats, I think, might blow the Senate seat in Wisconsin. But that, of course, assumes that the rules are somewhat understandable, that there's no way that Eric Greitens could possibly win a general election. There's no way that somebody who has been as deplorable as Josh Mandel could possibly win a general election. But that may not be true anymore. I mean, things are so polarized. It's like trying to figure out how far our political culture has devolved. And I sense that we haven't hit bottom yet. Or close.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I'm long on America. I think we can see our way out of this. I think that we shouldn't forget that when we were faced with Trump, narrow the victory may have been. It was a victory for Joe Biden. The ninjas have confirmed it. And that, you know, we can build a big, broad pro-democracy coalition over time to kind of hold off this dangerous version of the Republican Party. But there's a lot of different things that have to come together to make that happen. You know, Democrats have to nominate the right people themselves that can appeal to that broad coalition of voters. Joe Biden and the Democrats have to get it together. One of the biggest indicators of whether or not you're going to get just destroyed in a midterm is going to be the approval of the president. There's a long time to go. It's a year out. Joe Biden gets COVID under control, does a couple key things. You know, he can get this back to a manageable place. And then Republicans have to go sort of where I think they want to go anyway, which is full Trump, you know, the Herschel Walkers and Eric Greitens and Josh Mandels. And over time, I think the people who suffer from what I would call kind of the Reagan hangover, where they have this vision of the Republican Party, they consider themselves Republicans and they think Paul Ryan's going to like walk in and save them any minute.
Yeah.
Like they are going to slowly come to the realization that the party is not what they thought it would. And they will continue this demographic shift of these, of moving away from the party. But I think you've got to do everything you can to help accelerate that shift through messaging and telling people the truth about what's going on, and to every day not lose sight of the stakes and get sort of sucked into the little squabbles over the policy stuff, which I have lots and lots of opinions on. I've always cared about policy. But there is a clear and imminent threat. You know, I think JVL and I were talking about it being like, you know, people talk about, well, there's a liberalism on the left. And I really believe that. I think there is a lot of, you know, stuff going on in colleges and universities that is totally problematic, that is illiberal. Sure. But when you do a threat assessment for what is facing us right now, it's like you having cholesterol while you're high cholesterol, but your plane is crashing. Like the plane crashing is the more imminent threat to your life.
See, this is something, and this is painful for me because I have spent years writing whole books about the craziness in higher education. I mean, this is something. I wrote a book called Proskim, I wrote a book called The Hollow Men, A Nation of Victims, all of those things. And you're exactly right. It is, you know, we're watching our democracy being attacked. We're watching an insurrection. We're watching, you know, this mad orange king pushing for restoration. And yet, okay, yes, we have some crazy things going on over in the English literature department of Oberlin College. So, okay, yes, it is crazy. You know, yes, there are crazy things happening at the University of Southern Arkansas. But what is the comparative threat? What is the comparative weight that we put on these threats? We can deal with those threats, you know, once we've dealt with the bigger threat. I think that's the problem, Sarah Longwell. Oh, one last question. With your focus group, you asked them about what they thought about the Texas abortion law. What did they say?
They thought it was insane. So these are swing voters, and this
strongly thought it was crazy.
And I think that this is, again, Democrats are going to have to get really aggressive. And I think they probably will on this one, because it's kind of a gimme, around sort of the vigilante element, because people don't actually automatically know about that. It's not deeply penetrating the psyche. Like, you have to tell people, this is just something I say as somebody who does messaging all the time, that you may be sick of giving a message, but there's lots of people who still haven't heard the message.
Right.
And the thing that Republicans do is they just never get tired of saying the same things over and over and over again. And that helps them drive narratives in a way that Democrats, I think, just have never quite gotten a hold of.
Is that you pounding the desk in the background?
That is me pounding the desk. I'm losing my mind.
You're just saying, this is what you do. You need to pound this and pound this and pound this and pound this, because it may be old to you, but it is new to them.
That's right. That's right.
So we haven't even gotten around to talking about Chris Cuomo, which I don't want to do. So,
well, we can talk about my podcast.
We have been talking about your podcast, because in your podcast, people listen. First of all, Amy Walter is always somebody whose opinion needs to value. But I was really struck by listening to the kind of the unsuspectable takes of many of these voters that they were so squishy on the spending things. But the passion on the abortion issue and the vigilante aspect really sort of jumped out at me. And I would strongly urge people to listen to that, because that was, I actually had to go back and replay that, because you got real passion from those folks going, no, nuts, no, absolutely not on that. And if Democrats would understand, you know, because they're all focused on, no, we must spend $6 trillion on various things that nobody understands, as opposed to, guys, you have your own wedge issue right the freak there.
It's right there. I mean, and that's the thing about messaging wars, right? There's a reason they call them sort of wedge issues. But you've got to focus on where it's about what's top of mind for voters. right? It's about how they prioritize things in their mind. I will tell you, I would just one note of caution. I think the abortion laws with the vigilante part is a key to establishing what I think is the most important broad narrative, which is that the Republican Party has gotten too extreme to govern,
right,
which is what I think Democrats need to be using that as an example of a broader narrative that they need to make clear. Because Republicans are going to go ahead and go back to some bread and butter issues over spending and taxes. And in the midterms, when it is a referendum on who's in office, that can be very, very powerful.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the ways to nationalize this election. I talked about this on yesterday's podcast. The Republicans know that they have to nationalize the election. Democrats need to figure this out. Democrats also need to realize it's not 1935 anymore. So
that's right.
Those would be two things as a takeaway on what seems kind of a bright Friday. Okay, so we started off kind of upbeat. I'm not sure that we kept the upbeat tone throughout the entire podcast, but I have to say, as soon as I get off the podcast, I'm just going to immerse myself in reading all the commentary about the cyber ninjas. This is a story I have to tell you. I'm going to wallow in. Without any apology whatsoever, I'm going to wallow in this for a while.
Will you enjoy that, Charlie? Sounds like a nice day.
And you enjoy your weekend. Sarah Longwell, thank you for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. Your podcast is now called The
Focus Group.
The Focus Group with Sarah Longwell, which was just spiking like crazy on Apple Podcasts this week.
It was. It debuted at number 12. It's, you know, been staying at the top of the charts. And I'll just ask, as you do sometimes for your podcast, you know, Charlie, I went and looked, because now I've been in like the back end. Your podcast, you may know this. It's a monster, man. The number of reviews that you have, like thousands of people have reviewed your podcast. I need people to go review my podcast. Your numbers are just incredible. Mm. Just incredible.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you like the podcast, please leave a positive comment. And if you don't, well, you know, find something else to do with your time, right? All right. Thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, the Weekend Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.